Hello and welcome to the Global Challengers podcast brought to you by the School for Cross-Faculty Studies here at the University of Warwick. My name is Linus Pardo and I'll be guiding you through this short series where we tackle some of the big questions and big challenges facing our world today. The school is home to our Liberal Arts and Global Sustainable Development departments, and on these interdisciplinary courses we tackle some really big challenges and problems and we want to engage those with you through these podcasts. If you're a prospective student listening, don't forget you can find out more about our courses on our websites. Just visit warwick.ac.uk/liberalarts or warwick.ac.uk/GSD. In this episode, we're going to be dealing with the not-so-small topic of sustainability, its origins, what education for sustainable development might be, and what some of the solutions are for the challenges of sustainable development. Let's begin by talking about the Anthropocene. It's the notion that we have entered an entirely new geological era, one in which human activities altering the atmospheric and climatic and physical makeup of our planet have reached an unprecedented level. We don't have a fixed date for the start of the Anthropocene. Paul Crutzen and Eugene Stromer, who first popularised the term, have proposed the latter part of the 18th century and the early embers of the Industrial Revolution. Others have suggested the Trinity tests in 1945 with the first detonation of a nuclear weapon. Others have even suggested that it started thousands of years ago with the first deforestation of land and the planting of crops. Sustainability, meanwhile, in all of its diverse and strange conceptions, has grown up alongside the Anthropocene. Following the great acceleration of carbon emissions, biodiversity loss and resource depletion since the 1800s and especially since the 1950s, and the boundless social and economic inequalities that this has produced, the notion of sustainability has grown and grown as a response to the challenges of the Anthropocene. From cutting down on single-use plastics and reducing the consumption of meat, to creating a global action plan for alleviating poverty in the form of the UN Sustainable Development Goals. Sustainability is well and truly here to stay. But is sustainability really a new idea? Why is education seen as a key imperative for sustainability? And given its prevalence in our everyday lives, can we really achieve a sustainable planet for all? Well, I'm joined by Dr. Brian Brazzo, Senior Teaching Fellow with the Liberal Arts Department at Warwick. His research and teaching interests include Italian Renaissance epic, Dante and medieval philosophy, and the digital humanities. Brian teaches liberal arts modules on underworlds and paradises and sustainability in Venice. Hello, Brian. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Linus. Thanks for having me.
And we've also got, sitting opposite me, Dr. Alistair Smith, Senior Teaching Fellow with the Department for Global Sustainable Development at Warwick. Alistair has researched on a number of projects relating to fair trade products, food security and urban sustainability. He teaches on a number of modules in environmental principles of GSD, food security and praxis of local sustainable development. Alistair, hello.
Hi there, it's great to be here.
So, the small manner of sustainability. What is it? Where does it come from? I'd love your thoughts on the origins of sustainability. It began, some would say, in the 1970s and 1980s, but is sustainability a much older idea?
So I think it would be worth differentiating between the ideas of sustainability and the practices of sustainability. And I feel like it would be worth going back to, well, certainly a lot longer than the 1970s, thinking about the stage of settled agriculture that you kind of alluded to, Linus. We can look at this stage of human existence on the planet and think about the practices that fitted much more sustainably within kind of natural ecological cycles. So this may not have been conscious reflections on the idea of living sustainably, but nevertheless, because of population levels and densities, are practices that we can now identify retrospectively as being fairly sustainable. That's not to give the impression that humans at this stage of their development were always sustainable living in harmony. We've got, for example, some really important instances of great extinctions where really early modern humans did terrible things to the natural ecology on the planet. But we can look at previous practices. I think it would be also worth looking back to kind of the beginnings of religious traditions, where we first start to get codified reflective thoughts about the interactions between human beings and their natural environment. Religious texts can obviously be interpreted in many, many different ways. To some extent, they are the precursor of sort of anthropocentric Anthropocene, the idea of human beings having the sort of the right, almost predestination, to dominate the earth, its processes, and other species. But we can also draw out kind of pro-sustainability narratives and discourses from those texts. So at that point, I think already we're starting to see some conscious thought about sustainability.
So even back to sort of the Abrahamic religions and their early texts, we've got two sides of the coin. We've got that man can dominate nature, but also that man lives in harmony with nature and is responding as a result.
Yeah, and I think we get that in two real interesting traditions. The first is the tradition of the sort of the Garden of Eden, right? And this idea of a lost paradise. This idea that man lives in harmony with nature until the fall occurs. And the sense of once man has fallen and in this fallen state, humankind needs to, in a sense, dominate the earth, needs to eat meat, needs to kill. Previously, there was a sense of early humans being vegetarians, early humans living in harmony with nature. And we could even take this up to the medieval idea of the Hortus Conclusus, the idea of the Garden of Eden as a closed-in space where man can't access it anymore, but it's this closed-in Eden on top of the Mountain of Purgatory in Dante, to which many explorers and many thinkers would try to return. One of the topics that we look at in the Posthumous Geographies to Paradises module is how these ideas of paradise and these ideas of living in harmony with nature actually animated colonial enterprises such as those of Columbus, which led to slavery, which led to exploitation, even though there was this sense of rediscovering this originary paradise. So that's really interesting, is how these ideas, even an idea of paradise where people might live in harmony with nature, can be deployed for, in a sense, an anti-sustainable kind of exploitation. At the same time, I think there's also the tradition of pastoral poetry, this idea of reflecting not on poetry about war, not on poetry about politics, but reflecting on the experiences of shepherds in their spare time while their sheep are grazing and what they're actually doing. And that's a really fascinating poetic tradition, which goes all the way back to the Greek poet Theocritus in the Idylls, which was then imitated by Virgil in the Eclogues. And we get this sense, especially in Virgil, of the intersection between these poets who were thinking about what it meant to live in harmony with nature and the impacts that imperial expansion had. So if we think of the first Eclogue in Virgil, we get this reference to the expanding Roman Empire right after the war is the appropriation of these lands, and somebody who's been cast off this land, who then is sitting there and has no land for himself, who meets another shepherd who's roaming about. This comes all the way up to the Renaissance with someone like Sannazzaro, who writes this pastoral poetry, which is about escaping the sort of the Neapolitan court, and the sense of the self, which is inescapable in nature. And I think this is one of the really interesting ideas of sustainability, is how much it's tied with our concepts of selfhood, of who we are, and of our place within the world. And this links up with ideas of the Anthropocene as well, along with these kinds of religious traditions. Another way we might be able to think about sustainability is by looking at some of these early modern cultures and how they would approach issues of sustainability. One of the texts that we're going to read on the Venice module next term is this book, A Forest on the Sea, by Carla Poon, which looks at how as Venice began to grow its own empire, Venice itself was quite small and needed forestry. They had a massive shipbuilding industry, they had a large printing industry, and to maintain this, they had to colonize other lands, particularly in the Adriatic, and manage forestry there so that they would have a sort of sustainable logging operation for their own economic enterprises. And this extends also to feeding the Venetian population. It extends to importing wheat from territories, as far away as Cyprus. So there are initial ideas of sustainability, even if they're simply tied to kind of a sense of economic sustainability, but this idea of environmental stewardship, which is quite important.
Yes. I think that you picked upon the context of colonialized enterprise, and I think that's a fascinating context within which to think about sustainability, because there are these kind of two arms and many greys in between. But on one hand, you have a discourse and a practice around exploitation. But on the other hand, you have this kind of growing reflection about the sustainable use of resources. You start to get the development of quite formalized concepts that still exist today, the idea of a sustainable yield. And I think woodland management is a fascinating example that you identify. The same thing happened in British colonial enterprise and management. foundational empirical research was starting to identify that, you know, when you cut down all the trees, it changes something about the climatic, the local weather pattern, should I say. It changes something about the hydrological cycle, the way that water runs off and degrades land. And this, it is instantly realized by these managers, is a problem for sustainable forest production. In the context of Britain, this is tied really interestingly to kind of nationalism. The idea that Britain as a naval power, even by the early modern period, is fundamentally reliant upon a sustainable source of wood for the navy and for shipbuilding. And this becomes a real key point of kind of policy concern and practical management. And then as we kind of move forward in time, coming, I mean, missing out a large historical period, but thinking about kind of the post-Second World War independence period, people who've been involved in the colonial enterprise contemplating their need to extract themselves from this situation and embarking upon this sort of rather awkward set of thoughts about how the passing of power back to the local population, even though they've been basically using or involved in the land for reasons of plunder and exploitation, suddenly become concerned about this, that other people will not use these lands in a sustainable way. And by many accounts, this is a kind of the birth of the modern set of reflections on sustainable development and human interactions with the environment, which I think is has many fascinating contradictions.
Yeah, and I think in that swath of history between the early modern period and today, you know, of course, what happens is we get the Enlightenment, we get the establishment of the sort of central subject, which is often, you know, white and male and Eurocentric, and this sense of the central subject who has complete dominion over nature. And I think that's something very different from the sense of the subject existing within a moral cosmos or a religious cosmology that we might get in the medieval or early modern periods. You know, this sense of the land belongs either to God or to the king, there's a sense of almost a kind of respect that's different from seeing it as a sense of cold nature. You know, if we look at Francis Bacon, you know, an early scientist, he describes nature and getting nature's secrets out as the binding of Proteus, this sense of you need to physically bind nature because it will shapeshift all it can until you finally extract its secrets. And I think there we really see the beginning of this Enlightenment mentality of the centrality of that subject and nature as just this cold, lifeless form to be exploited, which I think is quite interesting now, because I think with these modern conceptions of sustainability, we're almost looking back to, in a sense, this pre-Enlightenment approach to nature and other ways of relating to nature.
That is a really interesting point, and the fact that in some ways we are now starting to turn back to these older practices of human relationships with the environment, where we're starting to understand the issues that emerged after the Enlightenment and into the Industrial Revolution of human domination over the environment, and how now we may need to live in greater harmony with the environment. And that begins to push us towards one of the main questions of this podcast, which is, how do we transition from kind of loose ideas about sustainability into what some of us may be familiar with as sustainable development?
So I would situate that in the post-war period, the coming together of two separate but interrelated discourses. So that of an interest in material welfare of human beings, so largely getting brought to the fore by the victorious Western powers and applied to the developing world, the Third World, as it was then referred to, but also with an increasing recognition of the importance of reflecting on environmental impact that the traditional development, quote-unquote, model had kind of propagated.
I think one of the interesting things about this development model, and you're right to point to the post-war period and, you know, this sort of the victorious powers sort of putting forward this idea of developing the Third World, of course, this distinction between First World, Second World, and Third World presupposes the Iron Curtain, and it presupposes the division of the world into two main systems, right? A capitalist system and a sort of a communist system, which both have very different ways of kind of very different models of development and exploitation. And I think that's a political context that I think underlies this movement from sustainability to sustainable development that is sometimes forgotten, right? This idea of development in the Third World, oftentimes development so that people's material living standards can be increased and a particular country or nation will not fall to communism, in a sense. And that sense of increasing material wealth, material standards, in a sense, seems to run almost counter to these ideas of sustainable development, because the idea was very much to make people comfortable, to help them exploit as many resources as possible. And I think we still see the legacy of many of those ideas in the developing world today, where there's this sense of one needs to be sustainable because this idea, or one needs to develop sustainably because this idea has global currency. At the same time, the sort of the basis of the developmental ideas and the developmental structures that have been put in place, they bear this legacy of trying to create, in a sense, this socioeconomic system that is predicated on exploitation.
By that token, does that therefore mean that in some ways, or in many ways, sustainable development as we know it today was a Western idea?
I think that's a great question. I don't know enough about the Eastern traditions to really speak to that in any great depth. But I would say if sustainable development is not particularly a Western idea, I mean, I imagine there would be sustainable relationships with nature that we might find in the Hindu traditions or in Buddhist traditions or in South Asian traditions. At the same time, I think the current iteration of sustainable development, if not Western, is certainly Eurocentric and US-centric and very much predicated on this idea of we want to be more comfortable with the way that we're interacting with nature, even if that comfort is somewhat illusory. I'm not quite sure if that makes sense. What do you think, Alistair?
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's definitely important to acknowledge that there were certainly other geographies from previous times where people were having these conscious, reflective concerns with regard to environmental sustainability. But I think so. Something we can know in a more certain way is that the sort of contemporary formal ideas that certainly we interact with in Europe, in the UK, came out of broadly kind of United Nations set of institutions. So in the 70s, we see the first international conference around the human environment. And there's this slow iterations of efforts to tie together these two concerns, the long-standing concern in kind of international human development and increasing recognitions of problems of environmental sustainability. So there are a number of events, and then we have the sort of the foundational commission, the Brundtland Commission, and the report published in the 1980s. Now, as I understand it, that commission went around the world to various different countries, obtaining a wide range of ideas that tried to connect these two ideas, the concern with human development and environmental impact. Although there were other lesser known, lesser famous statements around the idea of sustainable development or development that's sustainable, the Brundtland Report really kind of draws together those two discourses and for the first time offers something concrete that then, as we know very well, the rest of the world is encouraged to hang on to. This idea of, you know, the famous definition, development that provides for current needs without undermining the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. So in that sense, I think, yes, it certainly comes through these very Western-controlled set of institutions.
So if you're fairly unfamiliar with the idea of sustainable development and you're just kind of starting to get to grips with this as an idea, then the Brundtland Report is in many ways the cornerstone of our present-day understandings about sustainability and about particularly sustainable development. But as we've just discussed over the past few minutes, the origins of getting to that point, of that definition, have been on a much, much longer path. Alistair, you mentioned there the 1972 UN Conference on the Human Environment, which is one of the really, you know, early getting together of world powers to discuss the idea of sustainability. And one of the key things that came out of that was the idea of education. Since then, education has been placed at the very, very heart, the very core of the vision for sustainable development. Now, in various different ways, you both teach sustainable development and you teach about it. What does the term education for sustainable development really mean?
This really links up with many of the things that we do in the liberal arts course. The students in the liberal arts course take a full year module in the second year on sustainability along with one on consumption. It pushes students, I think, both in those modules and in my Venice module, along with in my module on science, society, and the media. The goal is really to have students who are critical and engaged, active citizens, students who are able to enter the world to see how messy and complex things are, and to deal with these problems, to be able to, you know, attack these problems as they are, to begin to draw out certain questions, and to begin to address them and think critically about them. So what we really try to do in the liberal arts course, and what I try to do in my own teaching, is to help students become more familiar with complexity, to help them know the unknown, if that makes sense. And I think that links to education on sustainable development in several ways, one of which is really this idea that sustainable development can seem overwhelming. It can seem terrifying. You know, if you look at the most recent report on climate change, which says we have only 12 years or so to really change things significantly before we move to this, you know, apocalyptic scenario, many people, even very educated people, tend to just simply give up. They tend to say, this is too complex, this is too difficult, you know, and I can't deal with this. But what we try and do is really to get students to enter into these complex debates, to understand the different perspectives, the different stakeholders, and to start to puzzle out ways to address this. You know, the second year sustainability module, they do a good amount of complex systems theory, which is quite interesting. My colleague Tim Burnett teaches on that. And that's quite interesting because it allows the students to understand that if you change one aspect within the system, everything else changes. So quick fixes aren't always the right way to go about this. So I think education for sustainable development means familiarizing students with sustainability, but more than that, making them into critical and engaged citizens who can really address the sustainability challenges, not of today, but of tomorrow.
And why do we go about doing that? It's not from one single discipline, not from history, not from politics, not from economics or sociology. Why do we bring together so many disciplines together in both the liberal arts and global sustainable development courses?
I mean, I think as Brian rightly identified, these issues, these problems that we're facing within the sustainable development agenda or the sustainability agenda, they're not simple. There's a reason that they've stuck around. They're incredibly complex, and therefore, I mean, to use the sort of the classic representation, you know, only having a hammer to attack a problem leads to a path-dependent course of action. I think we're increasingly realizing that approaching these issues with everyone working from one discipline, while it might help in some ways, we might find some positive outcomes, the bits of the puzzle get missed out because of the very way you're approaching it. If we can start to have interdisciplinary and then even cross-disciplinary approaches, we start to widen the scope of the team of actors that are involved in addressing these issues. We open up people's minds to not just approach it as, you know, I'm an economist, I bring my economics hammer, and that's all I'm going to do, but to have an awareness of the other kind of conceptual vocabularies, the other broad interpretations that other actors might bring, to have sympathy and sort of connections with other interpretations, so you have a much more kind of holistic and all-encompassing set of responses, either as an individual or also as a team of people working on something.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely what we do in liberal arts as well. I think the idea is very much not simply to say, oh, we're abandoning disciplines, but rather that we're bringing different disciplines together, and we try to really teach students to speak and think across disciplines. So we try and engage them with looking at the different languages that various disciplines use, how a historian might approach something one way, while a physicist would approach the same problem from a very different way. And those ways may sometimes be mutually exclusive and enter into conflict, but if one can see the different paths of thought through which these different disciplines approach this problem, one can actually translate between the two and serve as an interlocutor to build on a kind of transdisciplinary collaboration.
Yeah, and I think, and I'm sure you experience the same thing teaching liberal arts, but for me it's an absolute joy to work in this environment. With GSD, our students, the majority of our students at the moment, take a joint degree, so 50% in GSD, 50% in a complementary discipline. It might be history, business, economics, it could be theatre and performance studies, life sciences. We have a whole suite of options. And for the first year, we bring those students together and they do three foundational modules in the social principles for sustainable development, economic and then environmental principles for sustainable development. And I teach the last of those three. So we'll be having a workshop about an environmental issue. We use the planetary boundaries, so the nine ways that sort of human development is considered to be really pushing up against the sort of biospherical limitations and pressure points of our planet. So that will be the focus, the environmental side. But I'll start to see the students who are studying economics bringing in their economic kind of concepts and ideas to bear on the discussion. And then the sociologists and the students who study sociology starting to sort of to push back and to critique with their perspective, and then kind of the life scientists coming back in and saying, well, hang on a minute, but you know, this, we've got to consider the fundamental ecology of this. So the fascinating thing is to the fact we're not kind of forcing this interdisciplinarity, that the students, by the very nature of the structure of the course, are starting to do these things themselves. And I think that's wonderful. It makes that approach itself sustainable for them leaving us and applying this in other contexts.
That probably there is along the ideas of what Stephen Sterling has called sustainable education. Rather than education for sustainable development, we have sustainable education, which is just a transformation of the very idea of education itself, that it is this organic hotbed of new ideas and new perspectives. That's not just a, you know, it's not just a bolt onto the curriculum of, you know, learning about a little bits about sustainable developments. It's really, you know, completely reorientating how we go about thinking about these global challenges. It's great to hear about how, you know, I can hear in the tone of voice that you're both incredibly excited about teaching on those ideas, and let's finish off a little bit here with discussing about the thing that perhaps we know at the very core of sustainable development today, which is the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. If you're not familiar with these are 17 goals and 169 specific targets, covering a whole range of issues from climate change to gender equality, to alleviating poverty, to access to clean water sources. These are a huge number of different goals, and it's really worth going and learning a little bit about these just to reflect in your own day-to-day lives. But what I'm interested to know is, do you think that these SDGs, as we term them, cohabit well together, or... And should we study them independently? Or when we're talking about education for sustainable development, should we really see how they fit together?
I mean, I think we can do both, really. We can begin by looking at a particular problem that these SDGs will eventually address. So we can look at, for example, poverty, and how is poverty linked to sustainability, and get students to begin reflecting on that and thinking about those issues, and then bring students to a particular SDG in their own time, so they can actively discover the knowledge from the various disciplines they need to come to the SDG and understand its impact, understand the stakes of the SDG, understand its timeline, and then I think slowly build up the understanding how that SDG sits within the context of the other SDGs, of the 2030 goal, and things like that. Because I think if one begins with all of the SDGs with the 2030 goal, it can seem overwhelming. It can seem, you know, very exhausting. You know, it's 169 specific targets. That can seem overwhelming, and I think many governments and many people in politics see that and just don't have the ability to digest that information. They don't have the ability to break that down and to think about it, and think about each one of those targets, think about each one of those goals, its applications, and then to build back up and to see how that fits into a very complex system.
So thinking about a complex system, you teach about sustainability in Venice. How do the SDGs fit into Venice? Today we know the news of the terrible flooding that has occurred in Venice, questions being asked about how people are going to continue to live in such a precarious environment. How do the SDGs fit into Venice?
I mean, they fit into Venice in various ways. And if we look at the issue of Acqua Alta, the issue of Acqua Alta and the recent flooding in Venice is so complex. It's not just simply a question of wind pushing water into the lagoon and flooding it. I mean, we have to go back nearly 1,000 years or even further to look at how the lagoon was initially built, with these sort of wooden pillars that were put into the sort of swampy mud and these pieces of marble that were laid down as the foundation for the city. Now, the city has always been kind of man-made and artificial. There was a huge debate at the end of the Cinquecento, at the end of the 1500s, between whether or not they should just let Venice silt up and build on top of it, or whether they should fight to keep it as this strange man-made, labyrinth, this strange human Atlantis, if that makes sense. And as we know today, you know, they fought to keep it in this way, but it is an unnatural land formation, a very unnatural land formation. On the one hand, Venice is sinking. On the other hand, we do have rising tides. But that's not the only part of the story. It gets far more complex if we look at the fact that we suddenly have a huge influx of tourism in Venice, which is actually putting more weight on the city, which is increasing the rate at which it's sinking into the ground. We have massive cruise ships that are coming in, which are eroding parts of the shores and parts of the foundations and structures that are there. On top of which, we have the Mose project, which has been, you know, projected since the 90s, really, and has been built as this really interesting system of interlocking barriers at the three entry points to the lagoon, but is still incomplete due to issues such as political corruption, due to issues such as political infighting, due to disagreements between municipal, regional, and national governments. And I think this, you know, quick panorama helps illustrate the absolute complexity of this one situation of just flooding in Venice, which seems so innocuous, but, you know, is something where it could get worse over time. It will get worse over time, and it could really destroy, you know, this wonderful treasure.
So that web of problems, really, then we can use the Sustainable Development Goals as a lens for looking at you know, really complex issues and seeing the various different perspectives that we need in order to try to at least alleviate some of those problems in the first place.
We can also use them as various lenses. I wouldn't even say as one lens. I think you could look at various SDGs, various targets, and use them as multiple lenses to have a multifaceted approach to these really complex issues instead of separating them out issue by issue to keep this complex web of issues and then to filter them through one particular SDG or another and to try to think about how those might be implemented.
I think it's also important to remain critical of this kind of discursive lens that's created through these set of goals, which is very powerful and it has a great pull for a whole load of stakeholders, not least because there's funding attached now to the United Nations Sustainable Development Agenda, right? But kind of going back to this prior question of what is education for sustainable development, I'd pick on three things, and I'd say one area is subject knowledge. So we want people to understand relevant historical processes, certain like ecological sets of knowledge and scientific understanding, as well as social science ways of interpreting and reaching conclusions. But we also want to encompass an important set of skills, not least the skill of kind of critical reading and criticality, which we then use to reflect on the whole kind of the big picture itself. And the third bit being the idea of affective learning. So we're looking to change in some ways the very people that our students are when they leave us, as compared with maybe when they entered. But thinking about the goals, our head of department made a fascinating presentation for the beginning of our current academic year, questioning or raising questions rather about the bits that might be missing from those goals. So where is the place for democratic decision making, for participatory collective decision making, for that kind of collective? Where's a goal around deconstructing pernicious power inequalities? And if we wanted to get very political, we could turn that round on the United Nations itself and say, well, how where are practices that existing that maybe doesn't fit with wider kind of normative ideas about how we want the world to be? So that's, I think, also something that we very much want to encourage in our students, not a passive acceptance of this framework, which we don't stick to in a kind of a particularly rigorous way, but giving them knowledge which they can then kind of use the skills to critique these wider things.
Absolutely. And thanks both of you for coming and discussing all of this today. Incredibly interesting, incredibly eye-opening to get your thoughts on things. Let me ask you one final question before we close off this episode. Is sustainable development the best solution that we currently have, this iteration of sustainable development?
I don't know if there's necessarily a best way to solve global challenges. Today in Science Society and the media, we were looking at the science wars, this sort of, you know, disagreement between postmodernist thinkers and between scientists and those who are involved in science and sociology of scientific knowledge. And one of the maxims that comes out of this is, you know, many scientists will say that no theories are correct, but some theories are useful. And I think that sustainable development, we could think of in this way. It might not be the best way. It might not be the ideal way. You know, we might want to rethink things in terms of sustainable consumption, in terms of sustainable existence, really, and sustainable engagement with the world and sustainable engagement with being itself. But, you know, I'm not going to get too philosophical here. I do think, though, that for now, sustainable development, the SDGs, and the framework that we have is one of the most useful ways of approaching some of these issues and of gaining attention around some of these issues and of getting people, encouraging people to recognize that these issues are pressing and they're not going away. They're only going to get worse, and we need to change our thinking about them dramatically if we're going to do anything and change anything for the world we want to leave our children.
Yeah, I really like the I really like that expression. I think that sums it up excellently. The idea that, you know, we should be looking for some kind of perfect response to an interlocking series of incredibly complex problems doesn't make sense. And the search for perfectionism is often the downfall of very good ideas. Right, they get dismissed because, you know, they don't quite do everything that everybody wants. So I think, as we've discussed, we've got a really valuable and relevant normative framework, the idea that things aren't the way that we want them to be and changes have to be made. We do have a framework that's starting to cover increasingly important ground. So we're not just, we finally started to escape this idea that, you know, economics is the only thing that we need to be talking about. It's beyond growth. It's way more complex than that. So it provides a very concrete set of call to actions in a very interdisciplinary way, as we've reflected. I think there are some big elephants in the room. So the questions of power, the questions of kind of participatory and grassroots involvement are things that might be added. The next set of questions is then about implementation and application. So you can have as a good mission statement as you like. The question is then, well, how is that operationalized? Is it operationalized along the sort of the true principles that drove that mission, or does it become co-opted, corrupted by certain actors as they take that on? And that is, I think, part of going back to the education for sustainable development, something that we want to equip our students to manage into the future, to have this critical reflection, both of the mission statement, but also its application, and for them to then be equipped in the future to continue to reflect, is this fit for purpose? Is its kind of operationalization appropriate? And through that means maybe we can find something useful for the future.
A lot of food for thought. Thank you very much, both of you, Alistair, Brian, for joining us on the pilot episode of these podcasts from the School for Cross Faculty Studies here at Warwick. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to check out our website at warwick.ac.uk/liberalarts or warwick.ac.uk/GSD. And we look forward to you tuning in to another episode. Thanks for listening.